This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have really the great pleasure of talking to Joy Harjo about, well, we're going to talk about a lot of things, but I want to talk particularly about her memoir called Crazy Brave. Joy's a poet, a script writer, a musician, someone I've known for a really long time, and I really am happy to talk to you. Hi, Joy.
Hi, Dave. It is so good to hear your voice after all these years.
Well, you as well. And you have a great voice. I don't know whether you sing, but you certainly could.
Yes, I do. I have 4 CDs of music out.
Well, so you do. You surprise me all the time. I knew you played alto sax, but I've never heard your music.
Yes. Now I'm working on a musical right now too, which involves story, poetry, and music.
What do you mind talking about it?
Sure. It's right now I have a commission with a public theater for the book of the play. But what's held me up is I started writing it, and then I started thinking it's a story that will change the origin story of American blues and jazz. And that's all I want to say about that. Anyway, right now I'm writing the book. I guess for a while I was trying to write it by writing the music at the same time, and I was getting all caught up and realized that I needed to finish the story first and then put the music with it. But it's difficult because, anyway, I'm in the middle of it.
And you're going to do both story and musical. That is hard.
Yes. And so I think like I'm writing and then I start thinking like a musician, or if I'm doing music and then I start writing. So I thought, no, I have to do one and then the other.
Will you also perform in it, or is that going too far?
That was the plan. That was the original plan, not by me, but it was suggested that. So I have a part right now for me in it, but we will see, you know, we will see, because I'm willing to give that up, you know, for the good of the play. So we'll see.
So yeah. What is the plan kind of for when that might actually come to pass?
Well, I have to finish writing the book first and get it okayed. So that's step one.
And then do they have a director?
No, we're not that far yet.
Right. So you have to, you write it and then probably have to work on it and finish it before it will actually be even be ready to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a process. It's a lot longer process. And it's the thing, I did a one-woman show, wrote a one-woman show, and the book will be coming out from Wesley in the next year or so, called Wings of Night Sky, Wings of Morning Light. And what I learned, what's so different about that kind of form, or even music, and there was music there that I performed in the one-woman show, is that it's much more collaborative, much more than if you write a memoir like Crazy Brave. A writer is, you're in your room writing, and with these other, you know, performance, there's collaboration. You have a director who can, you know, advise you. It's just very different.
Well, absolutely. And writing, it is so different to have, I mean, even in writing, you do have collaborators in some ways with, you'll have an editor and, you know, you might have a publisher and you might even have other poets who will read your work and help you understand it sometimes, but it's in no way that, I mean, it is much more solitary. And in that way, theater and film and all of the other arts that involve writing that are so collaborative are much more, you know, the time frame is so different in terms of your seeing the work to fruition.
It's very different. And even I was the one actor in my one-woman show, but I rewrote that show every time I did it.
Right, which is, it's like a performance.
Yeah, there was a constant kind of processing that went on.
So,
I think it would have been true whether I was the actor in it or not, because it changes.
So how long a period of time were you in this performance mode with that piece how long of a time did it develop?
The one-woman show, it took, I did the first draft, and the first draft was presented at the public theater in the first ever Native consortium kind of thing with new Native plays. And that first draft was over 2 hours, about 2.5 hours, and I had a band there with me to perform it. It went through so many drafts. I probably wrote about 300 drafts. I had an excellent dramaturg, and then performing it, it's, I guess, from beginning until the performance, it was a couple of years at least.
Well, so is there any place online where we could see a video of that one-woman show? It sounds really interesting.
There is no video. If you go to my website, joyharcho.com, there's some small pieces of video. But I don't have a whole video of the show. I've had people offer to do a DVD or help pay for a DVD who saw the play. But and that was the idea. The book's coming out from Wesleyan in a year or so, called Wings of Night Sky, Wings of Morning Light. And the original thought was to include a DVD. But, you know, that would be mounting a whole production in order to film it. And we don't have those kind of resources.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. I hope someone somewhere will commission you to put that play on again. I'd really like to see it. Well, let's talk a little bit about Crazy Brave. I have to just tell you, and I just thought this was a transcendently beautiful book, and the writing is extraordinary. It's really one of the most beautiful books that I've ever read.
Wow, thank you. You know, I'm an artist, so I go through a lot of self doubts, and I just did a reading it. I as a memoirist, not a poet, although of course I brought my poetry in, and there's poetry all through Crazy Brave. But I was going back through, and then, you know, again doubting myself, which I think is probably a good quality to have for anyone to, you know, it's always important to question yourself, but. You know, I was going back through it thinking, oh, I should have done this or I could have done that. But thank you.
Well, in, like anything else, no story is ever finished. And it is true. You know, it's always that one of those complications of anything written that, you know, once you write it, it kind of sets it down as if it was a final text where in many ways, as you did with your one-woman show, you could rewrite this story probably again and again and again, because your understanding of your own life will change every day. But I thought this was just incredible. And, you know, I don't even really want to talk too much about the story because I would not want someone coming to it without being able to read it from the beginning without any influence, but, you know, by knowing what it's about. But, you know, we can talk about it in broad terms. I mean, it is, you've written the story of your, you know, what it feels like is your early beingness and your becoming yourself. It's the part of your life when you became who you are. And, you know, I think that it was, I just thought that it was amazingly mythological, and that you wrote this, you know, you did structure it mythologically. You know, it's, you know, the, it's almost like a creation story.
Yeah, I like that. It is essentially a creation story.
Well, it felt like that. And, you know, the, even though it takes place in the day-to-day world, the, you, without, I think, in any way, distracting the reader, you know, you engage in the spirit world as if, you know, at the same time, simultaneously with the day-to-day, the mundaneness of daily life and the pain and constantly challenging difficulties of day-to-day life, especially for when you were young and growing up, the spirit world is always there.
Yes, it always is for everyone. There's always, I think there's several layers of consciousness, and in American education, we're trained to focus on the mental spectrum, and the emotional is really probably part of that mental spectrum, and what's called the spiritual, you know, ultimately it's all spiritual, is another kind of wavelength. But we experience it in our, you know, our consciousness. Our consciousness embodies the mental, the spiritual, which is the, I don't know, I don't want to try to define spiritual right now. And then the physicality, which also has consciousness and is at the same time spiritual.
Well, do you feel though that that most people today have trouble recognizing that spiritual beingness in their daily lives? That you know, that's part of the alienation, the struggle with alienation for so many people today, whether, you know, whatever their background is, whoever they are, wherever they come from, because there is so much of the material world that doesn't lend itself to a kind of spiritual language or to a spiritual understanding, because we are so disconnected from the natural world.
Oh, definitely. And I think that the internet and digital, et cetera, certainly has been, you know, and remains a global conscious miracle. And the way you can connect and the kinds of music you can hear and history, you know, you can take part in history as it happens across the world and so on. But it's oddly enough, even though we're highly connected, we're highly disconnected.
Yes. I know it is such an irony, and you know, it's very challenging to figure out how to work with those differentials. Mm-hmm. You know, the connectedness is absolutely real, and it enables so much communication and so much understanding. But at the same time, it's not, because you're not face to face, you're not real. You know, you have to wonder how that gets actuated into change in the real, you know, in actual human behavior.
Right, because there's a kind of signal with it, or a quality of signal in that kind of story or story making. I mean, humans are about making stories. That's what we do. We go out and make stories, whether we do it by texting, which is, you know, demeans language in a way, because language, I think for language to live, language prefers luxuriating in space and open space and interacting with others, and it likes a certain kind of physicality to you know, in its storytelling. And I think a lot about what happens, because I watch my children, you know, grandchildren, and now I'm going to have a great grandchild, how I've watched many of them, especially the younger ones, communicate primarily by texting. And I call them, you know, I can text, I also text too, but to me, there's something that each step of communication leaves more room for miscommunication, and we're losing breath and water and resources and deep kinds of stories that give a certain kind of meaning and make community in a way that homogenized or stories cannot.
Well, and maybe that it requires more effort. You know, the least effort it is to communicate is texting, mm-hmm. in some ways, and that the greater the effort, the higher the level of meaning.
Probably. It seems to be that way.
Right. So what would you say to, let's say you were talking to a 10-year-old about the world, about life, you know, how would you communicate the story? You know, what story would you tell them? Maybe drawn from your own experience, maybe drawn from your experience, your direct experience of spiritual beings. What would you say to them?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, it would depend on where we were, what we were doing, what the 10-year-old was going through, because then you make the story fit that so that the child has a kind of road or a way it needs to fit.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I think it's, you know, I think that's really right, that context, you know, it's too broad a question. It actually, in that way, is not a good question to ask. But I think your answer was good.
Well, what happens, like I was, you know, I, when my grandchildren, well, some of them were younger, and I was living near them. And I remember there were scratches on my door, and one of the kids noticed, and I said, well, yeah, you know, there was a bear. You know, I started making up the story, and it wound up someplace, you know, about the connection with bears, bear stories, and you know, you can just go almost anywhere with that. But it wound up back that I wound up in the story, and I don't recall it now, where it had something absolutely to do with that child was going through.
Well, you know, this sort of takes us back. I think that's a good kind of re-entry to the book Crazy Brave, because that is about you as a child and you're kind of beginning to tell your own story. And I was struck at the end, and I hope maybe you would maybe even consider reading a little bit of the end of the, of, I don't know whether you have it at hand, but it's the poem that you wrote, or the poem that you put into the book, which says, you know, it's you said it was one of your first poems, and it was where poetry essentially came to you, you know, where poetry, where you became one with and opened yourself to poetry so that it could, in fact, save you. You know that, I assume you, I don't know whether you have that handy, but.
I have it, or it's the fear poem. And you know, before we, I didn't want, I wanted to begin the book there. That was where I wanted to begin. I didn't want to go through all the other stuff. I didn't want, it was private. I didn't want to go through part of that story. And I spent almost 14 years fighting, you know, putting the book, and I wrote the book in so many different forms. At one point, it was twice as the size that it wound up being, because I had all these dreams and visions in it. And I was doing everything I could to avoid telling the early part of the story. I wanted it to start where I started shining and finding myself, not through all the other stuff. And then when I ran into my editor, Jill Bialoski, at a conference, and I thought I was only 7 years behind on my contract. And, you know, I'd done other books, you know, and fulfilled other Norton contracts, and had written, done, you know, produced 2 or 3 CDs and a children's book and all that. And then Jill says, "We're calling it in." And I realized that I realized, okay, I give up. Okay, I give up. I just sat down at my desk and said, "I give up." And then the story wanted to go through all that other stuff, which I didn't want to, and it was not easy to write. And I eventually found it. And I guess what's interesting, I just did a talk on this at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and you know, I don't get lost. I was in chaos too in a lot of this book trying to find it, but I don't get lost on land. First time I drove into San Francisco, I didn't even need a map. I just, you know, I just kind of know how to go. And the way the book finally found form was, it's in the shape of directions. And once I knew that there was east, north, west, south, and then it just settled in. But I fought, because I myself, or the spirit of the book, everything has a spirit. I fought it because I didn't want to tell about. It was shameful to me. It felt shameful to me to tell about all the ways that I felt like I had failed, even though I was a young child when things happened and they were out of my control. There's still some part of you that feels that you failed in a way because these things happened to you.
Right. Well, I know that comes through in the book. The difficulty in telling the story, I think, is real. But the fact, you know, you were brave, and you had the courage to allow that story to tell itself for you.
So anyway, that poem is called "I Give You Back," and that poem was in "She Had Some Horses," which was kind of, I guess, my breakout book. And it came to me because I needed it. And I think that's what motivated me to write that book, is because I felt that it could help, you know, if I could find my way through it, and then it could be helpful, because it's not just my story. It's the story of a lot of us. And I'm aware of something much larger than, you know, I feel like my voice is not really, I take care of it. I take care of it. It likes to sing, play saxophone. It's a similar tone. I mean, I have a very, my tone, I have a tone on my horn. It's my tone and my voice. I'm not Aretha Franklin. I love Aretha Franklin. I can be more Aretha Franklin on my horn, But my voice is what it is. It's the same voice that's in the poetry. And so it comes through, and you have to take care of it. And this poem came because I needed it. I was not wise enough to write this poem at that time. Yeah, I was not anywhere near it, but I absolutely needed it. I release you, my beautiful and terrible fear. I release you. You are my beloved and hated twin, but now I don't know you as myself. I release you with all the pain I would know at the death of my children. You are not my blood anymore. I give you back to the soldiers who burned down my home, beheaded my children, raped and sodomized my brothers and sisters. I give you back to those who stole the food from our plates when we were starving. I release you, fear, because you hold these scenes in front of me, and I was born with eyes that can never close. I release you. I release you. I release you. I release you. I am not afraid to be angry. I am not afraid to rejoice. I am not afraid to be black. I am not afraid to be white. I am not afraid to be hungry. I am not afraid to be full. I am not afraid to be hated. I am not afraid to be loved. To be loved, to be loved, fear. Oh, you've gutted me, but I gave you the leash. You have choked me, but I gave you the leash. You have gutted me, but I gave you the knife. You have devoured me, but I laid myself across the fire. I take myself back, fear. You are not my shadow any longer. I won't hold you in my hands. You can't live in my eyes, my ears, my voice, my belly, or in my heart. My heart. My heart, my heart. But come here, fear. I am alive, and you are so afraid of dying.
That is a great poem. I think that is a you know, really wonderful kind of consecration of the book. It does, you know, it tells, it in another way tells your story.
Yeah.
Well, so maybe you want to talk a little bit about your new work. I know you have another book out called Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings, and I'd love for you to talk about that title. I have not read this book yet, but I've seen the book and I've seen the cover. It's really a beautiful looking book. But where does the title come from?
Isn't that a good title? Yeah. It's funny when you look and there it is. And if you look at the cover, there's a one-pole stickball game going on that we play. And that game is often played for conflict resolution, you know, to work something out. And I think it would be great if the Republicans and Democrats had played a stickball game, you know, to resolve. Or I guess there is one kind of going on with words, but it's different. And the poem came about. It's not exactly about, it was motivated, but how the poem, the motivation is one thing, but they often come out very different than what I think I have in mind. And it was about a conflict that I was dealing with and in which I was being asked to do something that I couldn't in all consciousness do. And I was vilified for it. And I knew that it was going to be rough and that I would hurt people's opinions of me because they were so strong in what they believed. And I believed, too, in what they were doing. But I couldn't, you know, I believe that the arts, that we need to communicate past political boundaries, past regimes, past, you know, that the arts and our stories and our songs, you know, and we and the intellectuals and those, we can't let those hinder us, or we have to continue to reach across and to sing across and to play our music across those kinds of boundaries. So I wrote that poem in response to that, even though I don't directly address that. The poem comes out of being in Washington, D.C., and I was there at the same time in the same hotel with a contingent from our ceremonial grounds, the Hickory Ground people. And you know, I was thinking about how many times in this native peoples, and people in our tribe, and my grandfather, Manahwa, all, you know, go to Washington, D.C. for some kind of conflict resolution, you know, and so that was part of it. And then there was a quote in there, and I need to pull that book up. And actually, this gave me the title. There's a quote by Norman Patrick Brown. He's a Diné or Navajo poet, speaker, and leader. And this was on his Facebook blog one morning, and it was so beautiful, and it inspired me with this poem. I am the holy being of my mother's prayer and my father's song. And so I started thinking about how all of us are holy beings, no matter, we carry that promise within us or that light within us, no matter which part, you know, no matter where we are in this world. So
very good.
And then I borrowed, I went online and found all the different points for conflict resolution. So the poem is in different sections, like set conflict resolution, ground rules, use effective communication skills, give constructive feedback, and so on.
Oh, well, I will look for this book. I think it'll be really interesting to read that. So do you feel with poetry that it is still the core of your writing work, even though you do all these other things like music and theater and film?
I think so, in the sense that it's what it's all. I think when I play horn, it's poetry. It's a kind of horn poetry. When I have to think about it that way, so that it's all coherent and moves together, not, you know, so that everything isn't in separate pieces.
Yeah. So I know, you know, we don't have a whole lot more time. As we're talking today, it's in January of 2016, and something happened in the last couple of days that, you know, I wanted to talk about, and that is that your friend and someone I knew as well, C.D. Wright, passed away suddenly, and I was really just struck by that. It just came out of nowhere, and I know you knew her, and I guess I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about her if you wanted to.
Well, I didn't know C.D. Wright well. I know her poetry, and I have met her, and I've always been in awe of her. She's always scared me a little bit because she was always so, you know, I wrote this morning that she taught me about the eloquence, about eloquence, you know, and standing about eloquence when you're standing on the edge. And I always admired her poetry, and I always think she came out of Arkansas. And I think about that. I come out of Oklahoma. These aren't places that, you know, aren't necessarily thought of where the highest literary art comes out of. And yet it has. I mean, Oklahoma has its history, so does Arkansas. So I've always watched her and I've always admired her. So it was quite a shock to hear that she had passed suddenly without any kind of warning. And it's, you know, poets really, you know, she's a fine poet. And a fine poet is usually, it goes with the territory. We're space travelers. We travel within time. We're visionaries of a sort. That just goes with the territory. And I think particularly in this time when we need visionaries, when there's been such a loss or a decline in the quality of rhetoric and the quality of metaphor, you know, our metaphor even disappearing and the use of metaphor, and the quality of literacy. And here's someone who carried a brilliant vision and was a beautiful speaker and poet and had contributed to the quality of our existence in ways that aren't always way above the surface like many other arts. To lose her is stunning, and to lose her so quickly is stunning. And then what it asks, every death asks, you know, leaves us with some kind of question, and also always leaves its gifts in its wake, and also leaves a hole, you know, and we always So I'm feeling, like a lot of us, a feeling that that hole that she left, that which is also a doorway, because and we'll all follow. And I think that's what's come for a lot of us. I think a lot of us come in, a generation comes in the world together to work together. And so in a way, you, her, all of us of our generation came in to work on this thing called literature, poetry, North America, you know, this whole time period. And so she's one of us. And so that calls us to really take good care of her memory and her poetry, and to continue to take care of what we're doing without her. And that's, I think we're all feeling that.
I agree. No, I think I'm glad you said that. I think the word eloquence does come to mind from that, and the clarity and carefulness of language, and the ability and willingness to engage in beauty and difficulty and try to figure it out by being open to the words. I think that's, you know, that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Joy. It's really a great pleasure to hear your voice and to hear your thoughts. I really appreciate it. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Joy Harjo, particularly about Crazy Brave, but also about her other work. Thank you, Joy.
Thank you, David.